Hi, I'm Elise Lunan, co-host with Gwyneth of the Goop podcast. Today's guest is Dr. Jeffrey Bland. Before we get to our conversation, I want to give a quick shout out to our friends at Kohler who helped make today's episode possible. Having two young boys at home is a lot to keep up with, and lately I've noticed how quickly the house, especially the kitchen, gets cluttered, if we're being nice about it. I really appreciate ways to make cleaning up a little faster so I can relax sooner. The team at Kohler offers a range of kitchen and bath products that make cleaning easier. One kitchen upgrade from Kohler is a touchless kitchen faucet. It's completely hands-free, so it makes cooking and cleaning up feel a lot faster. And if you're washing your hands, you never have to touch the faucet in the process. That feeling of peace of mind extends from the kitchen to the bathroom with bidet seats, self-cleaning toilet technology, and the advanced cleansing features of intelligent toilets, all from Kohler. To explore their whole collection of clean kitchen and bath products, head to kohler.com/clean.
Don't hold anything too tightly. Just wish for it, want it, let it come from the intention of real truth for you, and then let it go.
For me, our soul is like it's unbound. It's limitless. But we will use words to limit ourselves.
When people stop believing that somebody's got your back or Superman's coming, we turn to ourselves. And that's where you become empowered.
Courageous participation attracts positive things.
I'm Gwyneth Paltrow. This is the Goop Podcast, bringing together thought leaders, culture changers, creatives, founders and CEOs, scientists, doctors, healers and seekers, here to start conversations. Because simply asking questions and listening has the power to change the way we see the world. Today is no exception. I'll let Elise fill you in on her extraordinary guest. All right, over to Elise.
Affectionately known as the father of functional medicine, Dr. Jeffrey Bland first trained as a biochemist, which he taught as a tenured professor, before turning his attention to the way that medicine was being widely practiced, as symptom management through disease codes, which are required by insurance companies to process payments. He strongly believed that we needed to start addressing the root cause of illness on an individual level, and so 30 years ago, he and his wife started the Institute for Functional Medicine. At this point, more than 200,000 physicians and practitioners have been trained. Dr. Bland has always been somewhat of a prophet, and so several years ago, he switched his focus to regenerative agriculture and ways to rejuvenate small local farms, healing the earth in the process. Currently, he's focused on reviving a superfood plant called Himalayan tartary buckwheat. Along the way, he has written many books, including The Disease Delusion, Your Health Under Siege, and Genetic Nutritioneering. In today's conversation, we talk about the ways in which the pandemic and heightened calls for social justice and equity are reflecting how we've gone awry in our healthcare system and in the way we live in general, that we must focus on the root cause of these issues at every level, rather than just trying to make the symptoms, however uncomfortable, go away. That this is a call to move upstream in our thinking to ensure a healthy future on this planet for everyone. One of the biggest takeaways from our conversation is that Dr. Bland is a strong believer in miracles. Based on what we've already been able to achieve, he trusts that we have the power and wherewithal to throw away old models of living and create new, better ones when we ask the right questions.
It doesn't require many of those experiences in your lifetime to recognize miracles are out there and they can be duplicated if we ask the right questions.
I'll let Dr. Jeffrey Bland take it from here. Well, thank you. I don't remember when we first spoke. It was many years ago now because we were in our old offices. But my conversation with you continues to ring in my mind, and I quote you often. And I know I'm not alone. I mean, you're commonly referred to as sort of the father of functional medicine and the first sort of scientist to start to reorient everyone's thinking around our connection to the gut. And then I guess now you're going beyond that and sort of our connection to the earth. So what was the first epiphany?
Oh, Well, first of all, Elise, thank you. I'm very privileged to have this opportunity to talk with you and what you all are doing in advancing this whole new conceptual of wellness and health and connecting it into sustainability, regeneration, both of the individual and the individual within the broader sphere of our planet is extraordinarily important. And I feel very lucky to have the chance to add my voice to those that you've interviewed that are, I think, bringing this whole new view of what the 21st century society might look like. At least that's my dream. So thanks so much for all that you do.
Oh, thank you.
So for me, my epiphany, I've been very privileged. And I think my life, as I examine it now over my 74 years of living, has been punctuated by a lot of very lucky things. And I think that often we don't give full appreciation for the things that might have happened that kind of set us on our way and gave us the ability to create our own identity. So for me, I was very fortunate. I started off with really two great parents that were always forcing me and stimulating me and supporting me to ask questions. So I was the universal question guy all the way through school. And sometimes that got me into trouble, but it was always never a dull day around Jeff Bland because he was always the guy asking 1,000 questions. that led me into eventually completing my undergraduate work in biology and chemistry and was going to go on to medical school. And that whole environment of the medical school kind of academic environment, again, led me into asking a lot of questions, which were back in the 60s considered disruptive. And many of my professors said, Jeff, in medical school, we just put our heads down and we just learn. We don't really ask a whole lot of questions. You'll have your rest of your life to do that. But, I was young and impetuous and questions were important to me. So eventually my advisor said, why don't you go over and start a PhD program in the medical school? Because, those people are supposed to ask questions. So it actually was a really good recommendation for me. And I then went on, finished my PhD, and then got my first academic job. And it turned out it was Earth Day year. The reason I was hired in that job, it was during the Vietnam War, pretty hard to find academic positions back then. I was very lucky because Earth Day was just starting in 1970. A lot of universities were starting an environmental science program, and the University of Puget Sound at Tacoma, Washington was one of them. And so they wanted to hire a chemist because it was in the chemistry department that could also teach environmental science. And because I had quite a bit of interest and advocacy in the environmental area as a graduate and undergraduate student, I was able to sell myself as an environmental science / chemist. So it was a very, very great place for me. It was a small college, and the university president turned out to like me. And as a consequence of that, I got a chance to teach and team teach with people in the business school, the philosophy department, the religion, history. I really got a very deep liberal arts exposure through both the environmental science component and also my nutritional biochemistry interest. That ultimately then led me to a sabbatical, which is, I think, one of my epiphanies, certainly at the top of my list, in which I was asked by Dr. Linus Pauling, two-time Nobel Prize winning laureate, and his wife, Eva Helen, if I would be interested in doing a sabbatical with his group, the Linus Pauling Institute of Science and Medicine down in Palo Alto, California. This was in 1982. And it was really one of those experiences for me that, first of all, I was very privileged and very humbled to be invited. But secondly, the experience of being there for 2.5 years and having a chance to run a research lab and to interact with my office right next to his was just one of those experiences that changes lives, and it certainly did mine. So when I finished that up, and his whole concept, a lot of people thought of him, as vitamin C. Other people thought of him as a quantum chemist. Some of people thought of him as the father of immunology. Some of them thought of him as a person who developed the mechanism of anesthetic drugs. I thought of him as the developer of the concept of molecular medicine, which he coined that term in an article in the Science magazine, talked about him, sickle cell anemia in 1949. So I thought of him as really being much more than any one individual discipline, being kind of a broad thinker that impacted virtually every discipline in science and health and in society. He was involved with free elections in Guatemala. He was doing science exchange with USSR, trying to get science and the United States to collaborate. He was involved, obviously, with Albert Einstein and Albert Schweitzer. I actually have a photograph that his wife had taken at the Schweitzer compound in Africa, where he was trying to mobilize with Albert Schweitzer and Albert Einstein the kind of signature of 30,000 scientists that ultimately led to the disbanding of atmospheric nuclear testing, which then this was during the McCarthy period, and it got him pegged by the State Department. He actually couldn't go to Stockholm to receive a second Nobel Prize because they took his visa away from him because they were considering him a communist sympathizer. So he was a very remarkable person, he and his wife both, to spend time and get to know the broad range of their activities. And actually, if I was to summarize, my view of the Paulings is that they spent their life working on trying for us to understand the connection between structure and function at every level. Structure and function of subatomic particles, of atoms, of molecules, macromolecules, cells, tissues, organs, organ systems, whole organisms, the planet, and the universe. Trying to understand the organizational structure of things that relate to their function. And his concept was, if you get the organizational structure right, the function will follow. And I'm thinking today with COVID-19, and I'm thinking today of this horrendous situation we've just gone through with the murder in Minneapolis of an individual that had absolutely horrendous portrayal of inhumane behavior enlisted in him. And I think about, what are the structures that lead to that function? And how do we change them? Where do we go to structurally change our society? And this would have been something that Dr. and Mrs. Pauling would have advocated if they were still with us today. So that was a major life change for me, obviously, because when I came back from that experience, I was going to go back and start teaching once again at the university and doing my research. And Dr. Pauling, as I was, had my boxes packed and my kids in the car and ready to drive back up to Washington State from Northern California, the last thing he said to me as I was walking up the door, he said, "Jeff, wonderful to have had you here the last couple of years. Hope we'll keep collaborating. But I just have one question, and that is your classroom big enough?" So when I got in the car and I had 1,100 miles to drive home, it was constantly on my mind. You know, what was the hidden message? And it's not too hidden, obviously, if you think about it. And so what it led me into finally recognizing is that he was asking me the question, is there a place that I need to take this mission that I have in life beyond that of the classroom of my university setting and the students that I have, the couple hundred students a year and that do research and activities with me, and do I need to broaden that? And that led me, when I think back, it's crazy. I had three children. I had a car. I had a house with a mortgage and a wife and parents that I had moved up and had my dad take early retirement from his job. So they were all up in Washington State. And suddenly I come home and the first meeting I have with my parents to say how nice it is to be back to see them, as I say to them, and I can still remember this vividly, I say, "So I made a decision on the way home, and that is I'm going to give up my tenure faculty position and I'm going to start a company to teach doctors how to do preventive medicine in their practice." Mm-hmm. Well, you could have heard a pin drop in the room, literally. It's like you suck oxygen out of the room. My father always loved me being a professor because, although he was an aerospace engineer, he always really liked to be would have liked to have been a professor. So he was kind of living vicariously through me. My mother was very proud of me as my professorship. I was well-liked in the university and was able to teach and had a big research group. And so they couldn't believe that I would be so really, really insane was the way they thought of this with all the responsibilities I had with the family and so forth. But after it calmed down and we got the oxygen back in the room and they recognized that I was actually serious, this was another epiphany. So this says a little bit about my parents. So my father, who couldn't believe I was being so silly after he collected himself, he says, "Well, Jeff, if you're really going to do this and I need to come out of retirement, because I am an accountant and I have run businesses in big accounts for the government, and therefore you're going to need someone to be a business manager, and I guess I need to be that person." So I had the pleasure then for the first 6 years of the company with my dad being my business manager, my wife being our corporate development person, and me being the guy out there trying to figure out what this was going to mean, because I had no business plan I had no really formal business experience. But, you know, sometimes you just go with a wing and a prayer and your intuition, and that was the best decision I ever made. So the combination of Dr. Pauling and Ava Helen Pauling, his wife, and then my own support of my own parents and my craziness led to what I think for now the last, well, let's see, that would be 40 years to be absolutely the right decision.
Yeah. No, and what you said about structure function is so wise because, you know, if the idea of functional medicine is that we need to examine the root cause and not just manage the symptoms, clearly what's emerging in society right now is an echo or resounding echo of the same thing. And yet our reaction as people, because we're so uncomfortable with looking deeply inside of ourselves or sitting in discomfort or exploring what that might be, is how can I reflexively get out of this? Like, what is the quick fix? What is the pill? Who can I donate to? What can I do in this moment right now to make this anxiety and this agitation and these feelings of unwellness and shame and anxiety go away? And collectively, and we're, you know, it's interesting that COVID is so deadly when there are comorbidities and other chronic diseases. Like, it's not working, right? Like, we have to learn how to spiritually, socially, physically go inside and be able to sit with it and then sort it out. And, you know, it's interesting with health, because I think for many of us, we haven't had anyone to shepherd us through that process, or even to allow the allowing of questions or curiosity. Do you feel like within the world of health that that's shifting in a palpable way, that people are starting to take more autonomy over their health and that more doctors are able to engage with patients that way?
Well, first of all, I just want to take a real deep breath and just celebrate what you just said. I think that was a manifesto of truth that you just said. And I'm not sure I could do a full justice. I think that was very eloquent, very insightful, and very targeted to the nature of the challenge that we have as a human species right now in carving out what the society will look like in the human culture in the century to follow. But in healthcare, I think the answer is an absolute. So over time, if you were to ask people what they know about genes, and this would not be people in the art of genetics, just the general public, they would say, well, a lot of what we are is inherited, and mm-hmm. we didn't really even fill out an application card. We just got the luck of the draw as to whoever our biological mother and father were, and then that's how we're hardwired. And that model has been taught in school. It's as part of what's called Mendelian genetics. We know about dominant characteristics and recessive characteristics. And that has a much broader effect than just biology, because that construct that there are these hardwired features that control and say who we are then become a form of social determinism as well. They create a broad reaching perception that there are things that are locked in stone that we can't do anything about. And therefore, such is life, and it sets up kind of a discriminatory caste system in some ways. It's a biologically defined, but it's a socially implicated caste system. And what has happened in the 21st century with the deciphering of the human genome is a pretty remarkable, it's actually revolutionary change in thinking. Because it is true, absolutely, that we do have genes and they are inherited. But it has now become equally true to understand that all these genes that we have in these 23 sets of chromosomes, 23 pairs, are not expressed all the time. I call them our book of life. And the book can be read in different ways in different environments. For instance, if you read a book on the rim of the Grand Canyon watching a sunrise, you may have a different emotion to those words that you're reading in the book than if you read it in the middle of a war-torn zone in which you're fearful for your existence. It may be mm-hmm. the same book with the same words, but the experience is going to be totally different. And that is the way our book of life is, our 23 pairs of chromosomes. they are not all being read or expressed simultaneously. Think of what would happen if that were the case, because in our book of life is the instructions to have every cell type in our body function. And so if you think of what happens if the chapter that's on the liver cell is being read by the heart cell, that could be a real mess. So basically, our book is read selectively. Our book of life is read selectively. And it's read at different times in different places by different cells to create different outcomes. That's called genetic expression. And the remarkable thing that we've learned since the Human Genome Project has been explicated and described is that the environment in which we find ourselves as a human being, that could be our physical environment, our nutritional environment, our social environment, our spiritual environment, all are influencing how these genes that reside in every cell, in every tissue, in every organ system in our body, how they're being expressed. And so this construct that we are hardwired to be something is absolutely fallacious. Mm-hmm. What we are hardwired to be is many things. We are pluripotential. We have all these opportunities to be magnificent different things, depending on what we practice and what environment we engage in and what our social, cultural, economic experiences are, will modulate how our genes are expressed and will determine how we look at and feel in the course of our living. And they will determine what we call our health, which is really our function. And they'll also determine our relative lack of health, which we have defined for reimbursement reasons to call disease. And right. I say that somewhat tongue in cheek when I say reimbursement reasons. And the reason for we have disease is it codifies certain specific types of the absence of health into insurance reimbursable disease codes that allows us to have Taylorism in medicine, which becomes mechanized. It doesn't ask where it came from. It just says what it is. And so that's, to me, the nature of the opportunity we have to create a whole new cultural environment of the opportunity for full expression of our potential.
Yeah. And you think too about one, how small our genome is, right? It's equivalent to like a slug. And two, how the world, how dramatically our lives have changed in the last several hundred years. And that we biologically like have not evolved in the same way. And so you think about sort of the assaults of modern day, whether it's chemicals and personal care products or our messed up food supply or the stress and anxiety of the way that we live that's outside of natural rhythms or the air pollution that we're inhaling. And then it's so interesting how we cling to this idea that our current system can support that or help us through that. And you hear it, obviously. I mean, you hear it all the time, I'm sure. But people will be like, detoxing isn't real. The body has everything it needs to do what it needs to do. And it's like, well, maybe if we lived hundreds of years ago, but we're our technology, our lives are evolving so rapidly. Like, where is our biology in this? Like, we've completely lost touch with nature and our food and the energy of the planet, which I think because we can't see it and we can't measure it in the same way means it somehow doesn't exist. Like, we're still stuck in this materialist, you know, matter on matter, do this and this is what happens world. Like, what? How much more disruption do you think needs to happen before there's a real paradigm shift?
Well, I think we're seeing that disruption right now. I think George Flynn is one of those disruptive agents that's of seismic proportion. I think that global climate change is a disruptive proportion given what's going on now around the world with its impacts on weather. I think the agricultural implications of processing just a few kind of calorie-producing products into the major food supply that produces food deserts is another disruptive indicator. And I think that what you just said, by the way, about those individuals who are naysayers that are holding on to the old model, a model that got us to a certain place, so I don't want to discount it as having no value. It did have value. But like all things, there is a time and place for certain ideas. and the time and place for those ideas that built this situation that we find today, it's not the time and place for our future to continue to perpetuate them. Now that we have 100,000 different chemicals in our environment that humans have made, now that we have changed the carbon dioxide levels just in the years since I started teaching in 1970, I remember talking to the class about carbon dioxide in the atmosphere being approaching 200 parts per million, and that if we weren't careful, we were going to see it over the years to come being able to raise the global mean average temperature by 2 degrees or more, which would create melting of the ice caps. This was in 1970. Now we see part per million of over 300 part per million for carbon dioxide just in my years of since I started teaching. And we see the global climate doing exactly what the predictors said back in the late 60s and early 70s. And this concept of detoxification, I find that ludicrous, that there are people still that are supposedly well-informed and well-studied who would say that there's nothing to detoxification, which we know that one of the most important families of genes in our body that occupies a great portion of our genome are the genes that code for the production of these enzymes that are detoxifying enzymes that are found in many cells of our body, particularly in the liver and in the intestinal tract, that handle endogenous and exogenous toxins. And if we wouldn't have had those, we would have, as a species, died out long ago. Now we're exposed to many more things, and we've revved up these systems to try to protect us. And now we learn that we have actually grown a coevolution with plants, that plants have agents that they produce in their own immune defense, that then when we eat those plants with those immune defensive substances, they activate our own immune defense systems related to detoxification, that we're totally tied through things like glucosinolates and polyphenols and flavonoids in our food supply that actually play a participatory role in how our bodies process foreign chemicals. And there are still people that somehow say there's nothing to this detox story. It's ludicrous. It's as if they lost biology 1A. So I think that we're witnessing a very, very important transition. And, you know, I'm banking not on a bunch of old geezer white males, of which I'm one. I'm banking on this next generation coming up of enlightened individuals who are throwing off old models and are looking at the world through a different lens, saying, is this actually the world that we both want to live in and think can survive beyond that of our own generation? And those questions, which are more than just cocktail talk, become real businesses about quality of life, not just quantity of dollars, become a very important driver for this new system.
We'll get back to Dr. Jeffrey Bland in just a second. Right now, it feels more important than ever to create moments of relaxation and restoration in my daily routine. I find that I feel so much more relaxed and more deserving of a nightly glass of wine when my home feels clean. We've been working with the team at Kohler for a long time. They also believe in creating more of these relaxing moments. They believe that clean is a universal feeling and that the little moments of joy matter. Kohler designs products that make cleaning easy, and they optimize products and experiences that give you that greater feeling of a clean slate. Among their many home innovations, Kohler makes hands-free faucets for the kitchen. You can wash your hands or food without touching the faucet, which makes cooking and cleaning feel much more efficient. There's no more hunched over with your elbow trying to get the water running while your hands are full. That ease and peace of mind extends from the kitchen to the bathroom with bidet seats, self-cleaning toilet technology, and the advanced cleansing features of intelligent toilets, all from Kohler. I'm a strong believer in thinking upstream, especially when it comes to our health. I sat down with functional medicine practitioner Dr. Robin Berzin a while back on the Goop podcast, and we talked about preventative healthcare and the ways we can bridge the gap between wellness and medicine. When Robin realized our current healthcare system was due for a major upgrade, she created Parsley Health. Parsley Health combines the best of modern medicine with a functional, holistic approach. Their mission is to get to the root cause of illness instead of just treating the symptoms, and to ultimately help people optimize their well-being. When you sign up with Parsley Health, you can expect hour-long doctor's appointments, advanced diagnostic testing that looks at everything from your hormones to your gut to your microbiome. Their doctors work with you to create a personalized health plan that factors in nutrition, fitness, sleep, and supplementation. You're also paired with a health coach who will support you and keep you accountable when you need it. A Parsley Health membership includes 5 doctor visits as well as 5 health coach visits per year. And now their online care program, Complete Care Anywhere, allows you to access your doctor and personal health coach from home. I'm a current member of Parsley Health and I love it. I really appreciate how easy the site is to navigate, and I love having access to thorough healthcare from home. Right now, Parsley Health is offering our listeners an exclusive offer of $150 off a year-long membership. Just go to parsleyhealth.com and enter code GOOP. That's PARSLEY health.com, and use code GOOP to get $150 off a year-long membership. Back to my chat with Dr. Jeffrey Bland. We have to figure out how to downshift from this dominance and, you know, feeling like we're distinct from nature and that we should dominate nature, and into this place of balance, you know, and that will require, I don't think it's suffering. I think it's a rebalancing of our expectations to have whatever we want, whenever we want it, at whatever price we want. Like, we're going to have to move past that. But it feels like we're all collectively awake and aware of how unsustainable this is and how close we are to the cliff's edge. I mean, so, and I know your next venture is in regenerative agriculture, right? So what's the vision of the future? Because you're clearly a seer and a prophet. So what do you think that what do you think is achievable for us, and where do you think that we need to go?
Well, what happened to me, you asked, we started this conversation, you asked what epiphanies have I had. So that this leads probably to my fourth epiphany. So I started, as you know, my wife and I started the Institute for Functional Medicine in 1990, which I'm very proud to say is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year, and now has over 200,000 licensed practitioners around the world that have gone through its education courses. So I feel really very, very proud to have been part of that. In 2013, then we formed the Personalized Lifestyle Medicine Institute. And the reason I did that is I wanted to kind of expand the envelope beyond that of just practitioners into other individuals who have affiliate interest in this whole concept of sustainability, upstream, what I call healthcare, and looking at the model of function as a determinant of health and not just the absence of disease. Because I think most of us would say that health is more than the absence of disease. And mm-hmm. So we formed the Personalized Lifestyle Medicine Institute in 2013 to explore that. And that's grown up and has a very viable life of its own. You can go to our it's plminstitute.org website. We have all of our educational programs that can be downloaded there free of charge from world-renowned leaders. And then the last part of that was to say, you know, the missing link in this kind of functions that I've been involved with, these activities, is the health-conscious consumer. And as I was talking to my colleague, Trish Urey, that's worked with me for over 20 years, about this one day when I was ranting, coming back from a weekend meeting and was ranting on a Monday morning, she said, so Jeff, you know, you're a fairly big guy, and you've got all these bold ideas. I think you ought to take this into a different venue, go directly to consumers with this message, and I think you ought to form a company, Big Bold Health. And I thought of that for a moment. I thought, you know, that's a really interesting kind of closing the circle. And Big Bull Health should then get down into the soil. It should start right for where this whole system starts, which is the complexity of our planetary environment and how that nurtures things like the soil, how that nurtures then the plants, which then creates the life as we know it, and ultimately us as human species. And as I was thinking about this, again, if there's such thing as serendipity, I'm not sure as I've gotten older whether these are serendipity or really you're directed in certain ways we don't fully understand. I happened into an article on an ancient grain that was really a major source of calories in the colonial United States back when our nation was first starting. And it had been brought through Europe from Asia, from the Himalayan region of Asia. It's called Himalayan Tartary Buckwheat. It turned out that when I was studying this and learning more about it, I learned that it is a really, really fascinating plant food because it has all these very high protein and high prebiotic characteristics, but it also produces the highest level of plant polyphenols of any plant food ever been analyzed. So it's like a factory of immune strengthening nutrients. And it's about 100, more than 100 times higher in those nutrients like rutin and diosmin and luteolin and quercetin and 2-hydroxybenzylamine. It's about 100 to 200 times higher in those than normal common buckwheat. So I got interested in why did we lose this crop in America and continental United States? It went away. And the reason for it is that because it's so high in nutrients, it has a flavor. And people wanted grains that could be made into snack foods, convenient foods, and easily made in all sorts of baked products and white bread. And it's not good for any of that. So it basically got lost in our agricultural system. It's a regenerative plant. It doesn't require fertilizer. It's very hardy because it has all these plant biochemicals in it. They resist insects. So it doesn't require insecticides or biocides. It doesn't require egg to be having systems that would require technology to grow it, high technology. So I started really becoming interested in this and found that there was actually only one farmer in the United States that was growing this presently. And he is in upstate New York. He and his wife is a nurse. He was a former Cornell University ag professor that went back to being involved with farming. And so we went out to his farm and met him and had a conversation, and he and I hit it off, and I said, well, why don't we redevelop this crop in the United States? I mean, it seems silly that this superfood is sitting, because it is a regenerative crop. It is organically farmed. It has all these virtues. And in fact, we can even support family farms because we could probably guarantee the price of this. It would be such that people wouldn't lose their farm if we would make this a value-added material. So he and I came up with the idea of let's go from his 20 acres to 10,000 acres over the next few years by developing a Himalayan Tartary buckwheat cooperative and teaching people how to grow this. Now, you can't buy seed because the seed doesn't exist. This is ancient seed that's 2,500 years in the making. And so we have to grow our own seed, and then we have to develop a relationship with the right farmer. So we started doing this just a year ago. We're into our second year of harvest now, or planting. And we're actually now getting a really interesting uptake of organic farmers who are having a problem making a living with kind of commodity products to want to take on some of the burdening of this regeneration of Himalayan Tartary buckwheat. So this gets my hands back in the soil. It gets me back into really some very fundamental things that we were talking about in 1970 when I started as a professor in environmental science. And it connects a healthy planet to healthy plants to healthy people in a very interesting way. And we consider this a big, bold idea. So that's kind of got my attention right now. And we're moving very rapidly to see if we can't meet our dream of not just having 10,000 acres farmed in this material, but actually with my food lab and people that I've had working with me for years, developing recipes and menu guides, with my clinical studies group, doing clinical studies on its health benefits as it relates to lowering blood pressure, improving glycemic response, lowering inflammation. So this is a whole new being rebirthed here for me at 74.
It's fun. I mean, and it seems like so many of these, like nature is, she's sort of like holding out her hands and continuing to offer to us, right? Like despite our negligence. And do you think that she'll show us the way, that it will be through, you know, long neglected superfoods or more responsible farming mechanisms that will be taught, like we don't need to abuse the soil with all these chemicals in order to, and from what I know, and in terms of talking to like Dr. Zach Bush, et cetera, about regenerative farming and other people in ag, there has been a lot of success in transitioning conventional family farms to regenerative practices, that they thought it would take years, but that they're seeing incredible resiliency in the soil and it bouncing back. What sort of timeline would you imagine for this next phase? And do we have enough time?
Well, I'm always going to say we have enough time because I'm a universal optimist that believes in the extraordinary capability of the human spirit when it's properly directed. So I've had a number of experiences recently that, for me, were very profound. I'll try to summarize two that I think exemplify a little what you're talking about. So I'm in the state of Washington, out here on Bainbridge Island. It's a little bit, it's a half an hour ferry ride from downtown Seattle. And so we're on what's called the Olympic Peninsula. It abuts the Olympic Mountain Range, the coastal mountain range. And over near the mountains, which are about 60 miles from here, is a place called Squim. It's a very interesting agricultural area. It's very interesting, actually, in the rain shadow of the Olympics. So it's a very interesting farming area. And there's a farmer over there that's been for 30 years a major organic farmer and one of the principal organic farmers to really pioneer organic farming in our region in the Pacific Northwest, and was providing through his farms crops into the natural foods markets in the Pacific Northwest. So we went out to visit him just recently. Now he's in his early 70s. He's got some younger people obviously working for him. And I got talking about his farm, and he said, "So Jeff, not too many years ago, we were farming 1,000 acres here, and you know we had over 75 employees working on our farm, and now we're down to 100 acres, and I have 7 employees." And I said, "Well, why is that? I mean, you have such a reputation. In fact, his carrots that you can find in some of the natural food stores have his name associated with them. And people up here in Seattle know his carrots by his name, Nash Carrots, Nash Hoover." And he says, "Well, it's a story that's happening all around the country that I'm not sure people understand, that when organic foods became much more popular and now suddenly big food chains wanted to start having some organic products, it became more profitable for big farms, industrial farms, to start growing it. And so what happened is that they had a way of systematizing the rotating of their fields from non-organic to organic. And so they could buy up a lot of properties. They can do the roll-up of small farms to make mega farms. They could then rotate the plots so that one plot would be organic and then the others would be non-organic around them. Because every 3 years, you know, you can stop using commercial pesticides and so forth. And if you don't use it for 3 years, you can recertify organic." So they have this all laid out in a time grid. And then the last year before it goes into this 3 year changeover, what he said they do is they dose up on a lot of biocides to get enough in the soil so there won't be weeds and there won't be a lot of problems. So when they grow organic, it kind of coasts on the history, and they can then do a similar mechanized farming that they were doing before and make this the products cost effective and profitable. And he said, "We can't compete with that as a small family farm that doesn't do this. You know, we are back in the old days of the way we think about this, that organic is organic. You don't rotate this in and out of conventional or out of mechanized farming into organic. And therefore we could not cost compete with these farms basically in the Sacramento Valley in California." And so they now bring those products up from California, and they have caused us to be less profitable. So this was very disillusioning for me. So then I went, I don't want this to be a downer story because there is a good part of this, I think, I hope. Then we went to our upstate New York farms, and we were having a meeting about how to expand our acreage for Tartary buckwheat with other growers. And we had two farmers there that were very, very interested in becoming part of our Tartary buckwheat cooperative. And one told the story that he had been farming for over 30 years himself, and he had just met with the bank, his bank, and his banker said to him that if they did not find a way to have something that was on their land that produced more revenue per acre, that they would have to foreclose on their loans because they were not going to be a going concern. So this is a guy who his whole life and his whole family has been involved in farming, who basically would have to sell his land because they no longer can make a living out of their land. And so the good story was that we have done some econometric evaluation of what we feel a value-added crop, Tartary buckwheat, could be sold for once made available and once people understood it. And so we came up with a per acre, per bushel price that we felt was realistic on speculation. And we said, here's what we could then guarantee, where we would pay on contract per bushel for tartary buckwheat that met these specs. And he, not knowing, you know, what he would need to make, he said, in so doing, that'll save my farm. Mm. That we will now make enough out of this that we can, we will no longer be in potential foreclosure. So I think there are solutions to these problems, if you get where I'm going. But it's going to require a different philosophy, and it's going to require a different approach. And it has to tie all this together. It has to tie the planet together with the soil, with the farmer, with the consumer, with the product manufacturer. There is a system that is a sustainable new business model in which health becomes the determinant, not just production per unit acre.
Yeah. No, and I think that, you know, it's so frustrating as consumers too, because we all think we're making good choices, right? And we're trying to buy organic, et cetera. And then to find, like, you're buying organic, it's like pre-poisoned organic. What's the point? That's having a deleterious effect downstream on in many ways. And so it feels like it needs a new accreditation. It needs a new system. It needs a way of understanding. And many consumers obviously are really well versed in this and have it down. But like, what are the area local farms? Are they regenerative? Are they focused on soil health? And can we then crowd out some of the bigger ag players who aren't really farming organic, right? I mean, it's also the age of transparency. I mean, I think we're all just desperate for the information so that we can make our own decisions and make concessions based on what works for our families and our own conscience, you know, like what we can tolerate buying from Amazon and what we can't tolerate buying from Amazon, you know, and by extension, Whole Foods. So it feels like you have the brain and the ability to create systems and to do this in a large scale way so that it becomes, there's a program, right? There's a way for us to understand at a glance what we're buying. And I hope it comes. I think we're all starving for it.
I think it is coming. You know, again, last weekend, no, it was a weekend before last, I spent the whole weekend in the rabbit hole of really trying to dig deep into understanding this COVID-19 at a fundamental level, and as best I could. And I probably spent, over the course of those 2 days, 20 hours really buried deep in the literature. And so I came out late on Sunday night, and my wife, Susan, who was a co-founder of the Institute for Functional Medicine with me, looked at me. She says, you know, I've been leaving you alone because I know that you were locked in here. You were in a zone, but you look like you've gone through a war zone. And, you know, what's going on in your head? And I said, well, you know, I'm really right now in this flummoxed position. I'm somewhere in the netherworld in between enlightenment and disillusionment. And I think that that's where a lot of us find ourselves today in the world of conflict and confusion that we're living in. On one level, we're more enlightened and we have more access to understanding and knowledge than we've ever had. But simultaneously, we're more disillusioned, maybe about what we've learned, that the story is deeper or more complex or more concerning than we thought it to be until we dug deep. And so the question is, where do we want to reside on that enlightenment to disillusionment scale? Because we have to kind of select where we want to be as an individual. I select to be knowledgeable enough to understand what this disillusionment means, but hopefully optimistic enough to know that enlightenment is the solution. And therefore, when I think back over the privilege that I've had over the last 40 years to work with literally tens of thousands of patients that have been not so well, in fact, ill, we saw well over 10,000 patients in the clinical research center that I oversaw from 2000 to 2010. And in that particular facility, we saw with our own eyes the results of changing our model. And there are countless case examples that I could give you that are the things that we recognize. You could either call them miracles, or you could say, through the experience of miracles comes the opportunity to create what we call standard of daily living. We learn through miracles how to generalize those things to other people. So I think of stories like a woman who, thanks to the advocacy of one of our docs, Dr. Jack Kornberg at the time, who said, I've read in the paper about this woman who has this very serious autoimmune disease. She was on the front page of our local newspaper as holding handfuls of drugs that she was taking and how problematic her life was in her late 40s with four kids and trying to make a way in her life. And I think we can do something for her. And I said, well, Jack, you know, that's a great advocacy, but, you know, what are we going to do? Call her up and say, come out here and be part of our studies? And he said, absolutely, that's what we should do. And I said, well, I'm sure she's seen by very competent medical practitioners already. She's got a serious illness. And he said, yeah, and I wouldn't want to offend them, but everybody has a lifestyle. And what we do is we help these people to understand how to manage that. There shouldn't be any conflict with their physician. So with his advocacy, we did contact first the woman, then her physician, who was a very prestigious rheumatologist, because she had this serious problem that was an autoimmune disease, very rare type of autoimmune disease that was so serious that it prevented her from really standing for very long. So she couldn't cook a meal at the kitchen counter. She couldn't go out and plant a garden. She couldn't go to the mall with her kids and walk. She was pretty much housebound. So we took her on as a clinical research subject in this trial. And over the course of 10 months, if there was ever in my mind a doubt as to why I'd chosen the right decision in my life, it would have been eradicated by the experience, because my office window was right into our parking lot where the patient parking spaces were for the clinic. So the first time I saw her come in with her husband, she was so disabled she could barely make it to the front door of the clinic on a walk with her husband helping her. 10 months later, I won't go through all the intervening period, but let's just say 10 months later, this individual who was on a handful of medications to try to block and treat her autoimmune disease had basically weaned herself off virtually every medication. And at 10 months, she not was just walking into the office, she was skipping into the office and actually gave as a gift to Dr. Jack and to the nutrition professional, Dr. Deanna Minnick, who was in our clinic. She gave them a gift of a photograph that was taken by her husband at the top of Mount Si, which is a mountain that's outside of Seattle that's quite a challenging walk. It's a trail, but it goes up about 3,000 feet over the course of just a few miles. So it's a really very strenuous hike. And here she is at the top of this mountain, holding up a sign saying, thank you, Dr. Jack and Deanna.
Wow.
Now, it doesn't require many of those experiences in your lifetime to recognize miracles are out there and they can be duplicated if we ask the right questions.
I know we're almost out of time, but I have to ask, in your 20 hours of head down work on COVID, did you have any revelations?
Well, I think my revelation just very quickly is that, and you already said it early on in our discussion, these things that we call comorbidities, which, you know, that's just a term. There really is no such thing as a comorbidity. What there are dysfunctions of the body that aggregate together. And the comorbidities that associate themselves with higher frequency of infection and severity of the progression of COVID-19 happens to be clustered around what we call metabolic syndrome. And we are now witnessing a COVID-19 pandemic laid over an existing pandemic. It's a global pandemic, which causes 14 million people to die prematurely globally every year, which is the non-communicable epidemic of disease that's associated with insulin resistance, obesity, hypertension, and inflammation. And it's that is really the gorilla in the corner. We are looking at the manifestation of a viral infection, which is definitely infective and definitely serious, but for over 80% of the people that are exposed to it have mild to no symptoms. The 20% that then do have the symptoms, and those that go on to the most serious, most often have these dysfunctions that are associated with preventable disorders that is the real pandemic that underlies the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And no one is doing anything about it. It is just laying there, causing 14 million deaths a year as a consequence of what we could be preventing.
Yeah.
So I think COVID-19 is a serious problem, but it is really just the entree point into understanding why it is that metabolic syndrome increases the severity of infection from a virus when you might think that those two are so dissimilar that they would have no relationship. And I could spend a whole bunch of time talking about the mechanism of action, how this occurs through the furin binding site and the spike proteins on the surface of COVID-19. I won't go there. All I'll say is we now are understanding why we have the severity in this disease in the boroughs of New York that are most suffering from socioeconomic deprivation and medically underserved.
Yeah. No, it feels, again, systemic and like another upstream problem, a problem that we need to be addressing upstream and not in ICUs.
Precisely. That's exactly right. And then the interesting thing about this is I marvel at what's happening right now in cancer therapy with precision cancer therapy and the whole nature of using the immune system to target oncogenic insults, the PD-1s, and this whole new class of drugs that are biologics. I think it's fascinating. And for those individuals who have been successfully treated, it's miraculous. But what we're actually learning through this has broader implications about the power that our immune system has when it's properly working. And what happens when our immune system is not working properly? Our immune system is not there just to protect us against cold and flu. Our immune system is working to operate as a functional level in every organ system of the body. And that, to me, is where I'm going to spend the last remaining productive years of my life, is understanding how we get people's immune systems not just to be supporting a damaged immune system is not what we want to do. We want to rejuvenate their immune system, because every 100 days, our immune system is reformed out of our hematopoietic stem cells. So is the immune system reformed to be the same as it was, worse than it was, or better? We have that opportunity to make that decision.
Well, thank you so much for your time and your brilliance, and I cannot wait to watch you solve all of these problems. Thanks for listening to my conversation with Dr. Jeffrey Bland. For more on Dr. Bland, head to jeffreybland.com. That's it for today's episode. If you have a chance, please rate and review. Hit subscribe to keep up with new episodes and pass it along to a friend. Thanks again for joining. I hope you'll come back for more. And in the meantime, you can check out goop.com/thepodcast.